Delighted to welcome to the programme my first guest this morning. He is author Tom Bower, and we're going to be looking at Tony Blair. Tony Blair, it's nearly a decade since he left Number 10, one of only two prime ministers since the Napoleonic Wars to secure an unbroken decade in Downing Street, easy for me to say. When he first came to power in 1997, moreover, he was the youngest person at the age of 43 to hold the post since 1812. He vowed that New Labour would modernise Britain, freeing it from sleaze, special interests and government secrecy. But now, of course, we see the legacy of Tony Blair really shadowed by the man that he's become. And I'm very happy to welcome Tom to the programme. Tom, let me ask you first of all, why did you decide to take Tony Blair as subject matter for this biography?
Well, good morning. Well, because following a huge argument I had with a friend of Tony Blair at a dinner party in London, I realised that although we'd all been told by Tony Blair and his supporters, like David Blunkett and Darling and all the ministers, what had actually happened in their 10 years in power, the truth was very different. So I set about trying to find out the truth about what really did happen in the 10 years as opposed to the Blairite spin.
And none of us who were, you know, adults watching the news at that time can remember the sense of or the feeling of optimism that, that welcomed in the new Labour with Dee Reams, things can only get better, with this young man who then looked very bright and very intent on addressing injustice and social issues and all sorts of bits and pieces that we were hoping he was going to address. It really was a time of great optimism for New Labour.
Oh, absolutely. May the 2nd, 1997, it was a very sunny day in London, and the helicopters were tracking Tony Blair driving with his family from Islington to Downing Street. And there were huge crowds on the street clapping him on, cheering him, because everyone thought that, most people thought that there was the beginning of a new era. We'd had a sleazy, crisis-ridden Tory government crash, and Tony Blair vowed to make things better.
What can you look back and sort of credit him with from those early days?
Well, I think he certainly changed the liberal feeling of Britain. I mean, some people might not like it, but in fact, getting rid of the discrimination against gays, helping people who were ethnically the minorities, helping the disabled, I mean, that was all in hand, but Tony Blair made it much more possible. So it became a more tolerant society. I think young people, on the whole, felt that it was a break from the past. And there's no doubt he finally settled the civil war in Northern Ireland. That was an important achievement.
Can that be credited to him, though, really?
Well, I mean, it was started by John Major. There are a huge group of people involved, hundreds of people, and not least of which MI6, the intelligence agency, destroyed the IRA from within, and that helped Tony Blair. But it did happen in his government, so one's got to give him credit for that. For the rest, I think that we were told that education got better, the health service got better, that the welfare benefits got better. But in fact, what my book shows, or what I discovered much to my surprise, is that everything actually did not get better. And of course, we ended up with a frightful economic crash and the legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan.
At what point do you feel, now that you've had a really close look at his leadership, that he started to form perhaps an uncomfortable relationship with the American administration?
Well, I don't think it was uncomfortable. I mean, what the book shows is, what I discovered and what I think people didn't realise, is that Tony Blair really did see himself as a global troubleshooter, the man who was going to change the world for the better. He wanted very much to be a sort of second-tier Margaret Thatcher after her Falkland success. And we might get onto this, but I mean, the whole point is that right from the very start, he changed the way in which the British Army and the military would fight. And for hundreds of years, the British Army, their priority was to protect the national interest, in other words, to prevent us being invaded. And he turned it into this global troubleshooter, what he called a force for good, to go around the world fighting evil. Now, that was all well and good, but he set them that task without enough money, without the right men, enough men with the right equipment, and he didn't think it through. And so when he began bombing Iraq with Bill Clinton in 1998, and by the time of the 9/11 attacks in New York by the Islamist terrorists, he actually wanted to remove Saddam. He was always keen on removing Saddam, and so he forged a very professional and very close relationship both with Clinton and with Bush to turn the world upside down, and that's what he wanted to do. It wasn't unhealthy. It was unhealthy for us as the legacy, but it was a partnership of like-minded people.
So you think it was genuinely altruistic at that time?
Well, it wasn't altruistic. I mean, he may have thought it altruistic.
Where did it come from, Tom? Did you find out where this desire to, you know, fight the global ills had come from in Tony Blair? Did you look that far back?
Of course. I mean, it starts to some extent with the West doing nothing about the terrible massacres in Rwanda. And then there was the dreadful mass murders in Srebrenica in the Balkans, where 4,000 people were murdered by Muslims. Because they had Muslims were murdered by Serbs because the UN failed to protect them, and he didn't want that to happen again. But the other thing was, he was a very naive man. He was completely uneducated. He never had read history and biography, so he didn't realize what he was getting himself into. He thought it was all terribly easy. You just sent the army somewhere and that was the end of it. He didn't understand that you had to have a strategy not only for the war but also for the aftermath.
I suppose it's hard to look at Tony Blair without looking at the woman by his side, and that being Sherry Blair, a very intent woman in her own right on certainly making a mark on his premiership or ensuring that her husband really left his mark. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think it is. I think what the book shows is that Sherry was at the heart of a very unhappy 10 Downing Street. Everyone seems to hate each other. And everyone fought against each other. And Blair was unable to manage those personal relationships. And Sherry just fueled the animosity in that building. And also shared with him this desire to be famous, to be rich, without any understanding about the content and the context. I mean, you know, history, the great giants of history, don't suddenly say, well, I'll be a giant. You've actually got to work hard at it, and you've got to understand your surrounding circumstances. And both the Sherry and Tony Blair were just ignorant about history and about the human past and what politics isn't just fighting the Labour Party. You've got to take people with you.
It's interesting that you refer there to their desire to be famous and to be, I suppose, excessively rich, because that really was a forebearer for much of what we see now in society, this desire, this idea that actually it doesn't matter what else you do in your life, as long as you become rich and famous for it, then that's your goal achieved, rather than having any fabric, any substance within your life in terms of having been able to put your name to something of real value. And you know, I wonder how much of Blair's premiership sort of set the pattern for that, for the world we see now, and for this almost, you know, this pattern in politics now, where politicians are very much, politicians are made into a certain mould. They don't seem to have an awful lot of depth in terms of intellect or particular character, but are really just a sort of, you know, shiny suited people who are towing a particular line.
That's a long question, Pippa. The easy answer is, I think, I don't think you can generalise. I mean, I think people would her opponents would say that about Thatcher. The difference is between Thatcher and Blair that she really did have an ideology.
Mm.
She did really believe that people should be free of the state, and that nationalised industries, the idea that airlines and electricity should all be owned by the state, or telephones, was ridiculous, and liberated people from the state. The problem with Tony Blair was he didn't have an ideology. He just had these words like modernization. But what did it mean, modernization? It was very hard to understand what, in fact, he was aiming for, other than sound bites. I would have thought that the great difference between Tony Blair and other prime ministers, not least of which Cameron, is that I do think Cameron, for all his weaknesses, does have integrity. And what the book shows is that the Labour government under Blair was very much built on spin and often deception. Well, not only deception about Iraq and Afghanistan, but deception about the social policies too, and also about money. He had a very, very strange relationship with money, and that goes to the heart of it. So I think he wanted a decent society. It was just that he didn't know how to get there.
So that goes to the heart of it, and of course that really is still the heart of it. We've seen this man, as you've described him this morning very eloquently, who now is on the world stage, on the global stage, has set himself up into a perhaps even more powerful role almost, because he's found himself jumping into bed with all sorts of people, dictators and despots in various parts of the world, and he garners immense profit and benefits from these relationships.
Well, yes, as you say, the book does show, I mean, it starts with this astonishing scenario where he arrives in the capital of Nigeria and pretends to be, arrives there under the umbrella that he's going to improve the government of Nigeria because he can show how he did it in Downing Street. He can transfer those talents to Nigeria, which is just laughable. But then at the same time, in private, he offers the president of Nigeria some various business deals, which annoys the president enormously. And I think what really it shows is that he wants to peddle influence. I don't think he's got as much now as he did when he first resigned and became the Israeli, being the peace envoy in Israel for the Middle East. I think that he's trading on his name. He's a broker of influence. He tries to get commissions from various people who are not exactly the great shining armor. I mean, what is remarkable, one of the most remarkable aspects of Blair's life, as you can read in the book, is that he put this country, Britain, to the test by fighting evil. He said we had to remove Slobodan Milosevic from Yugoslavia, we had to remove Saddam, we had to remove the Taliban. Fighting evil was terribly important. It cost a huge number of lives and a huge amount of money. And now, since he left office, he's working for these dictators. He's helping these dictators. Mm-hmm. So one has got to ask himself, which was the real Tony Blair? The one who fought evil or the one who profits from evil?
Well, that's right. And I'm always very confused as well by the media's response to him, because it's very, very clear that the man is hugely unpopular amongst the public, and in some parts of the media. On the other hand, he is always wheeled out whenever there is an issue and his comments are promoted. It seems such a discrepancy that here's the man who so many people really despise and see as being somebody potentially quite evil, whose word is still listened to.
Well, I mean, you've got to ask yourself who listens to him. I think it's a diminishing number. I think they did in the beginning. I think he tried in the Middle East, but he soon lost a lot of trust from people because of the way he behaved. I think he wants to foist himself onto the debate in Britain about terrorism or about Europe, but I think the audience is pretty small now. I don't think he really has the credibility he'd like.
Let me ask you, Tom, of course you don't know the categorical answer to this, but perhaps you're certainly better placed than most, having studied the man in such depth. How do you think he sees himself when he looks himself in the mirror? Does he understand, or does he still believe that he is some great crusader who is righting wrongs, or do you think he actually knows what he really is?
The truth. Well, yeah. You know, there's always this thing, and I spent my life writing about these shady characters, and very often people say to me, yes, but they are self-delusional. They convince themselves that they don't realize the truth. And my reply is always, you know, when a man walks into a bank with his face covered with a mask and waving a shotgun and shouts, give me the money, he's not self-delusional. He'll deny that he's the crook you've arrested, but he knows the truth. And I think that's always the same with these people when they look at themselves in the mirror. He knows it's a performance. He persuades himself that the performance is justified. But if he's challenged deep down, he knows the truth, that he's been found wanting and that he's deeply unpopular, and for good reason.
And blood on his hands?
Well, I think there is a lot of, he bears a lot of guilt. I think the Iraq, and I think even more importantly, the Afghanistan war were shocking He deceived the nation. He was not straightforward. He didn't do the planning properly. A lot of young men died or were maimed. A lot of money was wasted for no benefit at all, as we've seen in Brussels yesterday. It's a disastrous policy.
And, of course, Tom, the book is titled Broken Vows, but The Tragedy of Power, its subtitle, is really very, really a very specific and very, a title that reflects.
Well, it's a personal title because, you know, he, as you said at the beginning, he had so much hope. People were expecting such great things. And as you read through the book, you realise how one by one all these policies, whether it's education or immigration or health or that, it all fell apart because he didn't understand how to use power. So it was a tragedy in that sense.
Tom Bauer, I know I've taken more time than you were willing to give me because you're in a hurry today, but I thank you very much. It's been wonderful to speak to you. Tom Bauer's book, Broken Vows, The Tragedy of Power, about Tony Blair, is available through all of the usual outlets. Thanks, Tom.